Shrink Wrap Radio number 412, Meister Eckhart, Mystic Warrior for Our Time with Dr. Matthew Fox.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is the well-known theologian, Dr. Matthew Fox, the author of over 30 books, including The Hidden Spirituality of Men, Christian Mystics, and most recently, Meister Eckhart, Mystic Warrior for Our Time. A preeminent scholar and popularizer of Western mysticism, he became an Episcopal priest after being expelled from the Catholic Church by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict XVI. You can find out more about Matthew Fox by visiting our show notes for this episode on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Matthew Fox, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you on the show. I've heard your name over the years from graduate students who were drawn to your work, but this is the first opportunity I've had a chance to dip into it. And I believe I've heard your name in connection with something called creation spirituality. What can you tell us about that?
Well, creation spirituality is the alternative version of Christianity. It doesn't begin with original sin, but original blessing. It doesn't begin with anthropocentrism, but with the universe itself. It's not anti-science. It's very interesting in what science has to teach us about not only human nature, but nature itself and the cosmos and the history of the cosmos. And it's also feminist. It's also interested in the wisdom of women. And it really is the original tradition that the historical Jesus was about, because he comes from the wisdom tradition of Israel. And the wisdom tradition of Israel is very cosmocentric and nature-based and also feminine. Wisdom in the Bible is feminine. So this is not the tradition that built empires in the name of Jesus. This is a justice tradition. And, of course, given today's peril regarding ecology and global warming and the rest, obviously a rediscovery of the sacredness of creation seems to be very important in anyone's worldview and certainly in our religions.
Well, this sounds like something I could feel comfortable getting on board with. Is the term one of your own creation?
Actually, I got it from my mentor when I studied in Paris in the late 60s, Père Chenu, C-H-E-N-U. He was a 75-year-old French Dominican and a notable scholar and very important at the Second Vatican Council. He's really the grandfather of liberation theology, but he's the one who named the creation spiritual tradition for me. And when he did, it was like scales dropping from my eyes. Mm-hmm. It was a moment of awakening.
Oh, yeah.
That made so much sense to me.
Oh, sure. I can imagine.
Yeah.
Now, you have the distinction, some might say the dubious distinction, of having been a priest in the Catholic Church and having been excommunicated. Briefly, when was that, and what did you do to bring that on?
Well, I wasn't technically excommunicated. I was expelled from the Dominican Order, which I remember for 34 years. But what I did to bring it on was to faint, and that was not welcome under the previous two papacies, John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger. They brought the Inquisition back. So as I wrote about him in the book, The Pope's War, they condemned 105 theologians and expelled many of them, and they really brought the Inquisition back. They discouraged thinking. So in the list of objections to my work by Cardinal Ratzinger, the first was that I'm a feminist theologian. I didn't know that was a heresy. Mm. The second was that I call God Mother. Well, I proved that all the medieval mystics call God Mother, and that I prefer original blessing to original sin, and I don't condemn homosexuals. And they said, quote, I work too closely with Native Americans, unquote. I don't know what that means.
Wow.
Although it's true that I had Native American teaching with me in Holy Names College, a Catholic college here in Oakland, and he had sweat lodges on campus for our students and faculty and staff and so forth. So, you know, the problem with theirs, not mine. They condemned not just me, but Father Boff, Leonardo Boff, the most read Catholic theologian in South America, who's a liberation theologian, and the most read Catholic theologian in Europe, Father Eugene Drewelman, who was a psychologist. So we all got dumped the same year. So obviously it was a political act.
Yeah.
And they were trying to strike fear into other thinkers, getting people to fall in line. And I, what can I say, I wasn't eager to acquiesce.
Yeah, well, good for you. And I imagine that might be something like getting fired from a job and having it turn out to be one of the best things that ever happened.
That's right. Brer Rabbit, please don't throw me into that there briar patch.
Yes, you know? Yeah, right.
But it's, yeah, I got my pink slip, and I try to wear the honor lightly.
Yeah, great. Well, you've been a prolific writer over the years, and much of your writing has been about Meister Eckhart. And I imagine that there might be listeners out there who, like myself, have encountered references to the name Meister Eckhart without really knowing much or anything about him. So a good place for us to start might be to ask, who was Meister Eckhart?
Well, he also was a Dominican, like I was, who got himself in trouble with the Pope in the the early 14th century. He was a contemporary of Hafiz, who came right after Rumi in the Sufi tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably the greatest mystic the West has ever produced in terms of writing about the experience. But he was also very prophetic. He was socially engaged with the women's movement of his day, the Beguines, which were condemned 17 times by the same Pope that ultimately condemned Eckhart a week after he died. And he was also engaged with the peasants in Germany. He was the first intellectual to preach in German, which at that time was peasant dialect languages. And we found the transcripts of his trial in the 19th century, and in it the inquisitors complain about how he's preaching to the poor, telling them that they're aristocrats and that they're noble and that they're sons and daughters of God, and in their own language. And they said, if you preach in Latin, we'd let you go, but you're disturbing the poor. And Eckhart said, well, the poor need to know and need to learn. They'll never know how to live or why to die. And 10 years after he said that, the peasant wars broke out in Germany. So he was well aware of the division between the have and the have-nots in his day. And he stood up on behalf of the have-nots and on behalf of women. And he paid a price for it.
Yeah. Now, one of the first things you said is that Meister Eckhart is a mystic. And so what do you mean when you use the word mystic?
Well, the mystic emphasizes the experiential side of religion, the experience of God, the experience of unity and oneness and beauty and compassion. And one thing that's really uncanny about Eckhart, and this is really what I build my new book about, is that he went so deep into his own soul and his own tradition that he comes out at times speaking like a Buddhist, and at other times speaking like a Hindu, and at other times like a Sufi. And Carl Jung says that he owes the key to the unconscious to Eckhart. Carl Jung loved Eckhart, quotes him over 30 times. And that's what's uncanny about Eckhart, and what's so fitting for him at this time, because we couldn't understand him before today, I think, because we weren't aware of the deepest teachings of Buddhism, but Eckhart has them. So Dr. Suzuki, the Japanese Buddhist, in 1959 had a dialogue with Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk, and at the end he said, Tom, you're a typical Western dualist. Your one outside chance of understanding Buddhism is to read the one Zen thinker of the West, Meister Eckhart. And Merton said, well, he's been condemned by the church. And Suzuki said, well, I can't help that, can I? So Merton thought it over. In 1960, he did nothing but read Eckhart and Zen poetry. And there was a complete 180-degree shift in Merton from then on. He becomes a very prophetic figure in American culture. And and Eckhart was the key. And he wrote this in his Asian journal, which he wrote on a trip to Asia, which was his last trip because he died there. He wrote in the margins, Eckhart is my lifeboat, Eckhart is my lifeboat. So there you have an important Buddhist, Suzuki, saying Eckhart is Buddhist. Then you have Kumaraswamy, a great Hindu, saying that reading Eckhart is like reading the Upanishads. Well, that's about as great praise as you'll ever get from a Hindu. And then when I published my first book on Eckhart over 30 years ago, I got a 12-page article back from a Sufi. And it was an exegesis of just about four sentences that I had in Eckhart. He said, Eckhart is a Sufi. So Eckhart is amazing. He touches into so many traditions because he is so deep. He never read Buddhism. He just travels into his own depth. And really, it's complement to Buddhism that he came up with language and experience that Buddhism also speaks of. And it shows really the universality of a lot of Buddhist teachings.
Well, it really strengthens the notion that there is really one common religion. Maybe uncommon would be a better description.
That's right. That's right. Nicholas Akuza, a great 15th century scientist and mystic, David Bohm, the late physicist, said he owes more to Akuza than he does to Einstein, which is quite a mouthful. Kuzo said that we call ourselves by many religions, we're only one religion, and that is wisdom. And that's really what Eckhart was about, and it's what mystics are really about. And I think it's what mystics east and west, north and south are about. So, yeah, in this book, then, I try to take up each of these topics by chapters. So the first chapter is Rabbi Heschel, the Jewish tradition meeting Eckhart. And the second is about Teilhard de Chardin and Thomas Berry, today's cosmology encountering Eckhart, because Eckhart was very interested in cosmology, as, of course, most pre-modern thinkers are. And then a chapter on Adrienne Rich and the divine feminine in Eckhart, because Eckhart was very much a feminist. He says, what does God do all day long? God lies on a maternity bed giving birth. And that creativity is the essence of the Godhead. So then I have a chapter on Kumaraswamy, Hinduism, and Eckhart, and indigenous shamanism in Eckhart, and so forth. And then the Jung and Eckhart. So it all adds up to showing that, hey, we're in this together. And at this time in history, we humans have to draw wisdom from wherever we can and start living it. And I think Eckhart would be very much on that bandwagon.
Yes, well, as you kind of just hinted, your book is structured in a really interesting way. As at first I thought, oh, this is going to be made-up conversations with these different figures. And it wasn't structured quite that way. But it really does, in each chapter, you link Eckhart to the work of the personalities that you're treating in that chapter. And I found that not only was I getting a great introduction to Meister Eckhart, but also to those other people who you were featuring in each chapter. So I learned a lot about other people too.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, Thich Nhat Hanh was my representative of Buddhism, of course, too, and he speaks a lot about the need to recover the apophatic divinity, the God without a name, the God of darkness. And Eckhart talks a lot about that, what he calls God is super essential darkness, who has no name, and will never be given a name. So, and Thich Nhat Hanh says that when Christians rediscover this, we'll have a whole new Christianity, and it will be able to get to the deeper level of its own treasures and so forth. And I couldn't agree more. And Eckhart is an absolute champion of the apophatic, or the God of darkness and silence. So, there's a lot to learn from all these thinkers, and I'm glad that you were exposed in this book, not only to Eckhart, but to these other people too, because they're all worthwhile. They're all speaking a lot of wisdom to us today.
Yeah, there were new theological terms, too, that I encountered, and you were just using one, apophatic, and I think was cataphatic the other one?
Yes, right.
Yeah,
right.
So say again what those two are.
Well, those are Greek words, and they're about the cataphatic is drawn to the light, and apophatic is about no light. And, you know, we get this, phatic is obviously the word for light. We get the word photography from that, for example. And so the god of light is the god of awe and wonder and creation and beauty. But the apophatic is, as I said, is the god of darkness and silence and nothingness and no projections. So you need both. You know, there's time for light in our life, there's time for darkness, just like every day has both light and dark mm-hmm. in it. And too much Christian theology in the West, anyway, is all about presuming we know who God is, whereas the apophatic is missing, and that's who God is not. That's the great mystery. You might say there's the God of history, of light, and creation, but there's the God of mystery, which is darkness, and that's what you encounter in meditation, but also in dark times like we're living in. I talk about our living in the time of the dark night of, not just dark night of our soul, but the dark night of our species. So I think we're in kind of a collective darkness today. Our species is wondering if we're going to survive, if we're going to change our ways enough to survive. And this is where the apophatic comes in too, because it's an invitation to be in the dark and to be quiet and to allow things to happen.
Well, speaking of these dark times, there's a lot of focus on the Middle East right now with the turmoil that's going on there. And you already mentioned a Sufi connection that Sufis experience Eckhart as speaking to them. Do you think Eckhart would have any light to shed on darkness and light? Would he have any light to shed on the current conflict in the Middle East?
Well, definitely. First of all, justice is very, very important to him. He says, the person who understands what I say about justice understands everything I have to say. So his is not a spirituality of withdrawal or of mere contemplation alone, but it is about compassion and action and justice and healing and mending. And in that regard, he's very imbued, I think, with a Jewish spirituality in that regard. But I lay out what I call the four E's in the last few chapters of the book. The E of ecology, the E of economics, of education, and of ecumenism, interfaith. And I think that these are well represented in Eckhart's worldview. And I think that if we were really working on developing a new economics, one that worked for everyone in the world, not just all the two-legged ones, but for the forests and the soil and the waters, if we were doing this, I don't think we'd have all the appeal to radical political movements today, because there would not be that kind of suffering and poverty that launches so many wars. So just that alone is one of the issues. So too with ecology, if we could really as a species work shoulder to shoulder, no matter what our particular religious traditions or lack of them, about what is an obvious common problem, which is the survival of this planet as we know it, this would eliminate a lot of the strife that arises when we fall into our sectarian tribal natures. And the reptilian brain, which is that brain that wants to strike out at others and win lose consciousness, this brain has to be tamed. And that's what contemplation does. That's what meditation does. Mm. That's what a spiritual practice does. It calms the reptilian brain and allows the mammal brain, which is half as old, but extremely important. The mammal brain is about kinship. It's about family. It is about compassion. It allows that to flourish and assert itself more. So spiritual practice is very important for world peace, because without it, we're just lashing out at each other like crocodiles in a fight. The reptilian brain just runs away with everything. And it's obvious when 9/11 happened, the Bush administration and Cheney went to war in Iraq, which is the wrong place at the wrong time. That was pure reptilian brain response. It was not a fuller brain response that included thoughtful awareness of what really was the cause of this thing and an appropriate response.
They seem to have forgotten about Vietnam.
Exactly.
I was very impressed by that at the time. And, you know, I actually joined marches against it. And it was just shocking, you know, that don't these guys remember Vietnam? Now, I really, that's a new idea that you've just given us there, at least for me, of meditation, spiritual disciplines, having the effect of quieting the reptilian brain.
Well, you know, one reason I say this is that reptiles are not very good at bonding. They're very good at, that's not their thing. They're good at solitude. They like to lie alone in the sun, your snake and your crocodile and so forth. And being alone, entertaining solitude, is exactly what meditation accomplishes. So that's why I'm convinced that the calming of the reptilian brain happens with meditation. And without that, you have this explosion of reptilian energy. And I think it's clear that that's what's dominating our species at this time. And so it has to be tamed. And I think that's a part of the contribution of spiritual practices.
It sounds like meditation would be best practiced on a hot rock in the sun.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Say a little bit more. You mentioned Judaism in passing. Say a little bit more about the connection between Eckhart and Judaism.
Yes. Well, as I said, the book begins with a chapter on Heschel. And, of course, Heschel was such a spiritual genius. And one of his big emphases, and he had many, but this was probably his main one, was the importance of awe and wonder. And he says that the sacred is countered through awe. He says awareness of the divine begins with wonder. So that's an ancient Jewish teaching, that awe is the beginning of wisdom. So Eckhart, too, is very, very big on awe. And Heschel talks about radical amazement. Well, Eckhart talks often about amazement, being amazed and being fully amazed and being very fully amazed. So to develop our capacity for awe and wonder and amazement is really the first step in a mystical life. And it opens the soul up. And what results from that is a sense of reverence, a sense of gratitude, and a positive view of the world. And Heschel is amazing writing about that. For example, he talks about how the universe is not, how does he put it, it's not expected. It's really a big surprise that the universe is so amazing and it's so beautiful and it works and that we can understand it. All this is part of the awe and wonder and amazement at living. He's just terrific at, he's very poetic in his language, so he's just terrific at naming these experiences. But again, there's a real echo with Eckhart. And so they both were tapping into that depth of what the mystics call the via positiva, the path of wonder and awe and delight. Heschel also is very big on justice, as of course the whole Jewish tradition is. And, you know, Gandhi said, "I learned to say no from the West," meaning from Jesus and the prophets of Israel. Because in the Hindu tradition, the idea of reincarnation or repetition of cycles was an excuse for not standing up for the poor or the lower classes. And Gandhi was disturbed by that as a Hindu. And he had to step out of Hinduism and encounter this Western message of saying no, of the prophetic no to injustice when it comes to the untouchables in his world. So this is part of what the West has to give the East. The East has to give the West a lot, especially around this theme of contemplation and meditation and practices. But the West also can give the East a lot in terms of what I call holy impatience. So there's there's a room for serenity and patience, and there's a room for impatience. And the West is better at the latter, and the East is better at the former. And so we need each other.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. And when you were talking about the appreciation of awe and amazement, it put me in mind of Maslow and his focus on peak experiences, which to me seems to have a similar quality.
I think that's really endemic to all healthy spirituality, that it begins with this amazement and gratitude. And it goes on from there. Heschel talks about what he calls the immense preciousness of being, not an object of analysis, but a cause of wonder. Just to be is a blessing, he says, just to live is holy. So, and he says that wonder is where we should begin our depth thinking, not doubt. So, again, this is very concrete stuff. And it parallels a lot that you'll find in Eckhart, who says, everything praises God. And Heschel says, what we lack is not a will to believe, but a will to wonder. Mm-hmm. Stand still and behold, he says, the beauty and grandeur of the universe. So that standing still, that's the meditative dimension that we were talking about earlier. We have to learn to be quiet. The line from the psalmist, be still and learn that I am God. That stillness is a necessary requisite to take to our experiences of wonder, to deepen them and turn them into a sense of reverence.
You remarked earlier that Carl Jung had 30 references to Eckhart, and I've been particularly interested in the Jungian perspective and have done lots of interviews with Jungians. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about Jung and the ways in which perhaps he was influenced by Eckhart, and if maybe that shaped any of his ideas or concepts.
Oh, definitely it did. As I said, he himself says that it was Eckhart who gave him the key to the unconscious, and that key was letting go and letting be. Jung said the consciousness is always wanting to interfere and to take charge. So the key is to let go and let be, and he found that key in Eckhart. Jung, as you know, was the son, grandson, and great-grandson of Swiss Reformed ministers.
Right.
And his father was very much a fire and brimstone kind of preacher, and Jung didn't want anything to do with it. And Jung's first negative experience, if you will, that struck him so deep of religion was when he underwent his first communion, and he says nothing happened. It was not an experience for him, you see. Mm-hmm. And then he raised the question whether anything is happening in Christianity in his day. Of course, you know, he was born at the end of the 19th century. So his point was, though, where is the experiential dimension to Christianity? He did not find it in his Swiss Calvinist Reformed tradition. But he does say that he found life in Eckhart. He said Eckhart is the one Christian thinker that he found life, and that not only life, but that it nurtured him and nourished him to read Eckhart. There's this excitement in Eckhart. There's this ecstatic appreciation for being that comes through time and time again. And so Jung, I mean, he doesn't just reference Eckhart. He has a whole essay on Eckhart. And what he calls the relativity of God that is in Eckhart. And I think by that he means that that Eckhart is talking about our relationship to the divine and how we experience it and taste it. And it's not just dogma, it's not just a statement or a doctrine about God. There's something experiential going on. And Jung continually was kind of despairing of whether religion today is capable of leading us to experience, or whether it's just all wrapped up in doctrines and dogmas and even symbols and metaphors that are running out of steam, that need explanation instead of offering us immediate contact. So I think Jung was raising a lot of important questions about religion and psyche, and of course he himself said that his real vocation was not so much healing people from neuroses as it was about leading people to the numinous, to encounter the divine. So in many ways, I feel Jung was playing the role of a, call it a postmodern priest or a postmodern minister, that he was raising different questions about how to stir up the soul, the human soul, so that it could truly have experiences of numinosity, experiences with the divine. And I give him a lot of credit for his life's work, which was obviously very fruitful for very many people.
Yeah, that's interesting, because people have raised the question of whether or not Jungian psychology is in fact, in some ways, a religion, that people are drawn to it from a religious impulse.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. I certainly think it's a reforming movement to religion. Kind of like Luther didn't want to start his own religion, but I think he was trying to reform the religion he inherited. And that's true even of Buddha, who was trying to reform Hinduism. And Jesus, I think, was trying to renew Judaism. So in many ways, I think Jung was trying to renew his Protestant legacy as the son, grandson, and great-grandson of Protestant ministers. And he took another direction, and I think he contributed a lot. And I agree, I think that he has a very special appeal to people who are on a spiritual quest and are looking for something more experiential than simply doctrinal or dogmatic.
What do you think about his warning that we in the West should not overvalue Eastern spiritual traditions, but rather go back to our own Western roots?
Yeah, I like very much that quote of his. I use it quite often, where he says, "We Westerners cannot be pirates, thieving wisdom from foreign shores that has taken Asia thousands of years to develop, as if our own culture was an era outlived." I think that's very important, and really that's been important to me in my work, that I tried to dig deeply into my lineage as a Westerner, as a Christian, even as a Catholic, and to dig up what's valuable there. And there's much that's valuable, I think. I don't think anyone has to apologize for Jesus. We may have to apologize, we need to apologize for a lot of that Christians have done in the name of Jesus. But Jesus himself stands out as a unique mystic activist, a mystic warrior. And the world needs him. We don't need just more contemplation. In fact, the Dalai Lama said this in a speech a year or two ago to his Buddhist monks. He said, "We Buddhists," he said, "we're great at meditating on compassion and talking about compassion, but we should imitate Christians more in practicing compassion." Well, I'm glad the Dalai Lama has met some good Christians, but the point he's making is a good one, that we have to practice it, not just meditate on it. And that was Jesus' way. So I spent my lifetime digging into Eckhart and Hildegard of Bingen and Thomas Aquinas and Julian Norwich and the cosmic Christ as found in Paul and in contemporary science. So I am trying to do what Jung proposes, that we go deeper into our own culture and demand more of it. I mean, what's pitiful is that we settle for some of the crazy fundamentalism in the what I call kooky Christianity that is available today, and you see so much of on the media and so forth, is such a paltry and insipid and ridiculous interpretation of the tradition and of Jesus himself, that it's enough to make you sick. So you have to dig and go deeper and find out, you know, what's really valuable here. And that's what Eckhart is saying, that ultimately Westerners have to, and the Dalai Lama says this too, he doesn't want Westerners to become Buddhists. He keeps saying, you know, go to your own tradition and make it better. And so I also think that exposure to other religions like Buddhism and so forth can help Westerners to demand more of their own lineage.
You know, I grew up somewhat in an evangelical, charismatic version of Christianity, and you were talking about, which I departed from, I should add, and but I'm wondering, how to link that up with what you were saying about the importance of experience. It seems like there is a branch of Christianity that heavily values an experience, an ecstatic experience.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's to be put down, but what does experience lead to? In other words, experience isn't enough. Thomas Aquinas says that for teaching spirituality, experience is not enough. You also need concepts. So does the experience result in work of healing and justice and compassion? Or is it just a high that you undergo on a regular basis? And is that enough? William Hocking, the great American philosopher, says, The prophet is a mystic in action. So the mysticism and the experiential has to lead to putting your feet on the ground and contributing. And I think that's what we admire in people, whether we're talking about Dr. King or Dorothy Day or Cesar Chavez and so forth, you know, to carry this experience of love into the world so that others can experience it. And that's, of course, often a struggle. And you're going to get yourself in trouble, just like Jesus did. So simply having a high from the experience is not enough. It has to translate into service.
Well, I think the place where I depart from those people has to do with the literal response of fundamentalists of the Bible is the literal word of God, etc., and this is the only word of God,
right.
And so that kind of absolutism is not something that I think either one of us can endorse.
Well, exactly, and in contrast to that, in the tradition, we have like Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century saying, Revelation comes in two volumes, the Bible and nature. So nature itself, then, is a revelation, a source of awareness of God. And that's where science comes in. And that's where anti-science, anti-intellectual religion, the kind you're talking about, is very dangerous. Because then it gets reduced to pure projection, what you see in the Bible, and you can see anything there. So the idea that nature itself is a source of revelation, that's very important. And again, then, and by science, I don't only mean biological or chemical or physiological science or physics, but also psychology, human nature, what we can learn from human nature, from science, from psychology. And so all this is revelation. So that means our study, the use of our left brains is very important, along with our right brain, our intuitive, mystical brain. To get them both humming is very, very important. And that's the hope, I think, for our species, that we can do that.
Yeah. Science and religion, as you know, are often thought to be at odds with one another. Yet, you seem to feel that Eckhart might provide some resolution to this apparent conflict, given that the time in which he lived might be characterized as pre-science. What leads you to believe that?
Well, 150 years before Eckhart, Hildegard of Bingen, who was very much a scientist in the 12th century, as science was, she said all science comes from God. And between Hildegard and Eckhart, there was Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas developed his entire theology around Aristotle, who was the best scientist of the 13th century, and as I say, 13th century was rediscovering him, and it's to his credit that he said that a mistake about creation was also a mistake about God, and that is why we have to study science, because science tells us about creation, therefore it gives us insight about God and theology. So Eckhart followed right after Aquinas, and both of them were Dominicans. So Eckhart was very steeped in Aquinas's appreciation, and Hildegard's too, of science. That science is not an obstacle to faith or religion, but rather it can open revelation up, it can open doors up. And fast forward to today, I mean, Einstein said that we've been given two gifts, the sacred gift of intuition, he says, and the gift of rationality. But he says rationality is meant to serve intuition. But we live in a culture that honors rationality and ignores the sacred gift of intuition. So even Einstein says that you've got to have both these brains humming, the intuitive brain, the mystical brain of experience, but also the left brain of analysis and the verbal. So it's a dangerous situation when we have rationality serving rationality instead of rationality serving intuition. Einstein says values do not come from the intellect. They come from intuition and feeling. And therefore, he says, do not make an idol of intellect. Intellect must serve the values. And I think that really names the crisis in education today. This is why I talk about education, one of the big E's here with Eckhart, too, because we have to make room to develop the muscles of meditation, if you will, the muscles of awe and wonder, the muscles of creativity. And look at how education is happening today. This is why so many young people, I'm working with inner city teenage kids, and they're bored by school. That's why they drop out. Why are they bored? Because there is no appeal to their creativity. There's no appeal to the wisdom they carry within them, or to awe and wonder. It's all about taking exams. And this is no way to develop the full human person. So I think that education itself has to undergo a profound shake-up at this time, and I think that people like Eckhart, by daring to develop language around the mystical brain, are helping us to retrieve a balance between the left and right hemispheres of the brain.
Well, I know you've got an appointment coming up and need to go. I really appreciate everything that you've touched on here. And as we wind up here, is there any last word of what you just said? Was a great wrap, but anything else you want to say to wrap things up here?
Well, there are two endorsements in my book that really struck me, if I could cite them briefly. One is Larry Dawsey, who's quite well known as a doctor, a medical doctor, who's done a lot of work on healing and prayer and so forth, and a lot of studies about that. But he wrote me a note, and he said, in my library, I have a whole section on Eckhart. Eckhart is very important to me. When he wrote about this book, he said, whether our species has a future on Earth does not depend on the development of more gee-whiz technologies, but on whether we are willing to move into the psycho-spiritual dimension proclaimed by Meister Eckhart and elucidated by Matthew Fox in this important book. I quoted that in 2 weeks ago when I spoke in Silicon Valley, and I preceded it by saying, this is blasphemy, but I'm going to say it. But I really like his language, gee whiz technologies. You know, it's not enough that we have gee whiz technologies. What are we doing with them? Are we making the world a better place, a more just place, a more peaceful place? Are we getting into the hearts and souls of people? And if not, how do you get there? And can the new technologies help? And so I think what he's saying there is very important, especially to the younger generation. We've got to listen to these great mystics, and Eckhart is as great a one as the West has ever produced. Then one other line comes from Bishop John Spong, who's the Episcopal bishop, who's very much a biblical scholar, but very much a reformer and critic of the church. And what he said about this book really surprised me. He said, a stunning new vision of Christianity that transcends both creeds and boundaries, and it's a thrilling read. I didn't think of this consciously when I was writing the book, that it's a new vision of Christianity. But a man of Spong's stature and experience to say that about this book on Eckhart moves me, because I think he's right. Eckhart understood Christianity as to be about how every one of us is another Christ, and there's a danger in projecting everything on Jesus. And that's really at the heart of his teaching. And so I think Spong is right, that this kind of approach by Eckhart is a new way of understanding Christianity, but really it's very old, too. You see it in Paul, the very first writer, in Christianity. Paul was a mystic, and he was a cosmic mystic, and cosmic Christ he writes about all the time, but we've lost that in Christianity. So I do think Spong is right, that Meister Eckhart can help us to reinvent Christianity in the 21st century.
Well, that's a great wrap-up. Dr. Matthew Fox, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for the work you're doing, offering this opportunity.
Okay, Eric. Well, I think that one's going to have to go in my best of collection that I'm starting to put on the website.
Absolutely. A lot of really interesting information there. So what about the interview or the book itself? What stood out to you?
One of the things I realize about us using this format is I don't get a lot of time to think about what I'm going to say, but I'll wing it because that does work for me in terms of being a time-saving technique here. And so, and I guess one of the things that makes it difficult is that I try to say a lot of the things that, you know, are striking me in the interview itself. And one of the things that I commented on there was the fact that you get introduced to other people than Eckhart. I really knew nothing about Eckhart before getting this book, which is a wonderfully written book. You know, and I learned so much about Eckhart, both from the book and also from what he said. And then there were these different personalities, as I say, that I got introduced to. There were some contemporary ones toward the end of the book that I was particularly interested in, impressed by, and I'm looking at the book right now. That there was this woman that he discusses. Her name is Lily Ye. I don't know how to say it. She's a Chinese-American, and her last name is spelled Y-E-H. And she is a Chinese-American artist who is doing kind of what he was talking about in terms of turning their spirituality into a kind of activism and education in center cities of this country. I think Philadelphia, she's done a lot of work. And then in various countries around the world, getting students excited in art projects of various sorts, including the creation of gardens in blighted city neighborhoods and so on. I had never heard her name before. She would certainly merit a whole interview on her own. And similarly, there are just so many other personalities here that he writes about, and it ends up being just a great introduction to who they are, to their work, to their importance. He writes really movingly about Black Elk, for example, and I remember years ago reading Black Elk Speaks, and so it kind of brought all of that to mind. He writes about Rumi and Hafiz and Karl Marx. I'm just kind of glancing at the table of contents here. Just so many people that he writes about. So for me, that was a very strong quality of the book.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me in the interview, in talking about Meister Eckhart as a mystic.
Yeah.
And I've read about Jung often being called a mystic. I think in his day, that term mystic had a very different meaning.
Yeah, well,
I think it had
a negative connotation for him, right?
I think it was intended as a slight.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah, it was fascinating, the discussion of Jung as a kind of latter-day priest, in a way. I was impressed by that was Matthew Fox's take on Jung, which really, I can really see that.
Absolutely. You know, he talked a lot about Christianity.
Yes.
You know, he really went into the depths of it and exploring the lesser known aspects of Christianity in the past 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Meister Eckhart being one of them. You know, I myself didn't know much about him coming into today. Just read about him mostly in passing, but also Jung explored the alchemists and other occult societies that really had a lot to offer and really just did not fit within the mainstream paradigm.
Yeah. One question that I was tempted to ask, and then I didn't, was his guess, and maybe it would be more than a guess, but I found myself wondering, well, how did Jung discover Meister Eckhart? Somehow Jung was good at digging up these people who had gone before, you know. Mm-hmm. But Meister Eckhart would have been, you know, centuries before Jung. So I wonder if he would have known anything, you know, factual about that, or what he would have had to say about that. What was your religious upbringing, if I may ask? Did you grow up with any kind of particular religious orientation?
I was raised a Catholic.
Okay, as he was, evidently, or yeah, I suspect he was raised and also became a priest.
Yeah, you know, and being raised a Catholic, there were a lot of positive things that really came from it.
Yeah.
One thing that I didn't necessarily feel from it was the spirituality aspect.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the distinction that you're making there? What's missing?
Well, when I went to catechism, it was more like an academic study and
memorizing things.
Memorizing and reading passages as though they actually happened. In essence, reading the book, but kind of missing the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a really hard time connecting with, you know, the literalization of the Bible.
Okay.
So that really didn't last very long for me.
The Catholicism part didn't?
Yes. And I found that after I'd completed my sacraments, I had more or less lost interest because approaching it academically, I now had other academic interests that more or less take its place.
Do you think that early exposure might have laid any groundwork for your subsequent interest in and receptivity to Jung?
Yes, absolutely. I find myself reflecting on those periods quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And I, interestingly enough, when Mr. Fox quoted Einstein, actually, no, this was a Jung quote, "We Westerners cannot be pirates, thieving knowledge from foreign shores."
Yeah.
I found myself some years ago studying Buddhism and becoming really interested in getting into the practice of it,
right,
of meditation and what they had to offer. But there was still, I just couldn't quite connect with it all the way. And I think that has a lot to do with the culture I was raised in.
Yeah.
You know, because I grew up with heavy Christian background. Mm-hmm. And so to take this new concept or new spirituality, you know, as Buddhism, I couldn't quite get there with it.
Yeah.
Now studying Jung and in-depth psychology, I find myself going back to Christianity and thinking about, well, there has to be more to it. You know, there was a lot that I missed early on, obviously. So I find myself going back to Catholicism and Christianity and trying to figure out exactly what there can work for me today.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, as you heard, in this fundamentalist Christian religious environment. And interestingly, one of the things that I picked up in that was actually kind of preached was anti-Catholicism. Hmm. So here we are talking.
Yeah.
And as Matthew Fox expresses his ideas about religion, I find them like totally palatable. It's like, I could go to his church, whatever that is, without any difficulty. Not only without difficulty, but eagerly, I think.
Hmm. Yes, I could too. And I actually watched a YouTube video about Matthew Fox's Cosmic Mass.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you're familiar with this.
I am not.
So he actually is teaching people to conduct a mass, like a Sunday mass, but in a different way than what I was exposed to. I was standing there and, you know, being on my best behavior.
Yeah.
And what I saw is an opportunity for people to engage with each other, to dance, and to really explore the experiential side of spirituality, which seems like a very foreign approach to me, given my experience.
Yeah. That's one of the things that really appealed to me about what he said and in the book was the valuation of experience, of personal experience, rather than just handed down dogma.
Mm.
And that's something that I've for a long time really thought about and believe in. He's got a school somewhere, and I kind of got his different venues are mixed up for me right now. But he did mention that he had a Native American who was on his faculty. He was in the book. He says he was contacted by a Native American tribal leader who who said, I want to, you know, teach on your faculty. And he led sweat lodges and evidently taught other sorts of classes and so on. So sounds like a very exciting milieu that Matthew has created. Very exciting, very inviting. We could go on. There's a lot more here, but maybe this is a good place to wrap it up.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Thanks for your input, Eric.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm a graduate student, and I was really excited to stumble upon Shrink Wrap Radio and an article with an author whose articles I've been reading recently. It was very cool to hear. I chose to send a contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio because I really want to support this kind of grassroots educational initiative that's being done. I made a small contribution, and I figure, you know, for every I gained something from it by listening to it, and I would like to support that being out there for other people to hear, and I just, it's a really cool thing that you guys are doing, and so thank you.
Well, thank you, Heather. I hope others will be inspired by your action. Amazingly, there are thousands who are listening to this podcast series and who are not contributing, even though they have access to 412 interviews conducted over the past 9 years, and most with transcripts. So, if you're in that unwashed multitude, won't you please join that select crowd that have chosen to support us by clicking on that big multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar? And I thank you in advance, and I'll also thank you again with a personal email after you do. Now, you heard me mention to Eric that I thought today's interview would go well on the Best Of page. Over the years, various people have suggested to me that I should have a section on the site listing my favorite interviews, a kind of Best Of section. I've tended to resist that suggestion, in part because there have been so many really good ones that it would be hard to pick out one or two all-time favorites. Also, I've hesitated out of the fear of offending or hurting the feelings of guests whose interview did not make the top of my list. And then there is the issue of who decides what is best, me or some statistical measure of most downloaded episodes. Well, this issue reared its head again as a result of an email from listener Jeff Koenig, who wrote, "Hello, have you considered doing a best of show of either your favorites or the highest listener rated shows? I'm thinking that you might put together links to a group of shows following the same treatment philosophy, like those involved in somatic therapy, for example, Stephen Porges and Pat Ogden, etc." Somehow, either the timing of Jeff's prompt or his idea of having different categories of best got me to reconsider, and I've created a new page on our website, and you'll see a link to it in the left-hand sidebar, as well as under the Feeds tab. The list is not complete, and even so, there's quite a few there already. So do take a look at this work in progress and let me know what you think. As you know, I've been promoting our new sponsor, Audible.com, and I think most of you are maybe already members of Audible.com, but if you're not already a member with a subscription, then why not give it a try by taking advantage of their offer of one free audiobook of your choice from their library of more than 150 titles, more than 150,000 titles. I've been a subscriber myself for about 10 years or more, and I've always got an Audible book going. Well, I just checked, and yes, there is an Audible book there by today's guest, Matthew Fox, and he's even the reader. The book's title is Radical Prayer, Love in Action, and it's 6 hours and 44 minutes long. So if you liked today's interview, you can get a lot more Matthew Fox at his best for free. To get your free audiobook with no obligation to continue, go to audibletrial.com/shrink. Finally, I'm always trying to grow our reach. You can help by letting your friends, family, and sundry others know about Shrink Wrap Radio. Also, if you have a podcast of your own or a blog, please consider using me as an interview subject. I'll be happy to accommodate, and it would be a win-win.
Hi, this is Dr. Elisha Goldstein, psychologist, workshop leader, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
I have to say, Dr. Elisha Goldstein has really had good success establishing himself as an expert on mindfulness in the time that has passed since our last interview. Good for you, Elisha. Now let's dip into some recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Dr. James Alexander, listener and past guest, who writes from Australia. And he writes, "Dear Dave, I right now am at the airport on my way home from 4 days of training in coherence therapy in Sydney, and would like to thank you for bringing knowledge of this approach to myself and many of the other attendees. I first learned of this innovative psychotherapy by listening to your interview with Bruce Ecker a couple of years back. I was fortunate enough to meet up with some other people who were similarly impressed by what they heard, and together we formed the beginnings of what came to fruition this weekend with 36 people in attendance. Niall Gagan flew here from California to lead the training and did a magnificent job. We are all left with no doubt that coherence therapy has a strong future in Oz, and we look forward to more training opportunities in the coming years. To me, this experience is evidence of the wonderful resource which your program is for so many people around the world. I and many others are truly in your debt. Best wishes, James." Well, you can imagine how happy I was getting that praise. And then he followed up with yet another pat on the back for me, adding, "Most of the 36 people at the training on the weekend had heard of Shrink Wrap Radio. I heard lots of discussion about favorite interviews, etc. And really, I don't think the training would have happened if not for your program. Coherence therapy is up and running here as a result. Best wishes, James." Well, James, of course, that means a lot to me hearing that. And, you know, sometimes I'm operating here more or less in the dark in my lonely garret, putting out these shows, and you don't know what impact they're having. So I really appreciate getting that feedback. Next, we hear from not Australia, but New Zealand. And John writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just listened to episode 410, another great episode. Thanks for your great work. I really enjoy your interviewing style. You give plenty of space. And I especially like your post-interview comments. They seem very well considered and have a great warmth to them. At the end of 410, I heard a question from a Tony Johansson who asked about other podcasts you listened to. You didn't have other psychology podcasts for him, so I thought I would offer a couple that I listened to. I Procrastinate is a show about procrastination, which sounds like it is a bit single-focused, but the topic surprisingly relates to a lot of aspects of everyday life. Also, go to mentorcoach.com, and there is an extensive list of interviews with big names in positive psychology. I hope this is useful to a few of your listeners. Warm regards, John," and John is in New Zealand. Well, thank you, John, for those recommendations so that other listeners out there who are hungering for even more psychological content have some alternative places to go. So I think, once again, we'll wrap it up there for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our new message phone at 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemail using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Matthew Fox for introducing us to the importance of Meister Eckhart as a mystic for our time. I'm not sure who my next guest will be. In fact, I don't even have anyone lined up at the moment. I might just take a week off. I've hardly ever done that in the past 9 years. If I do skip next week, you can always go to my list of the best of Shrink Wrap Radio and catch one you missed or revisit one of your favorites. So for now, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.